Welcome to Podcast Against Antisemitism, the show that takes a deep dive into the world's oldest hatred. I'm Ellie, your host, and you can join us for new episodes every Thursday. Subscribe now at antisemitism.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you never miss a show. You can also watch the podcast on our YouTube channel. And please consider leaving us a nice review so we can grow our listenership. It makes a big difference. My guest today is the filmmaker Amanda Kinsey, who is the director and producer of the new documentary Jews of the Wild West. Through on-camera interviews, compelling footage, and historical photographs, the film tells a positive immigration story and highlights the dynamic contributions Jewish Americans made to shaping the Western United States. Amanda is a five-time Emmy Award-winning producer and fourth-generation photojournalist. She spent over a decade writing and producing for NBC before founding Electric Yoke Media, a production company specializing in non-fiction film content for broadcast and digital distribution. Amanda, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
You know, we were talking just before this. I watched the thing. I really, really enjoyed it. I'm a fan of Wild West things, and you don't really often get to see the genres of Wild West and Jewish stuff merge together. So that was pretty cool. Tell me, what inspired the documentary?
Sure. So I moved from New York City to Denver 5 years ago with my family. And I have been doing both broadcast television and documentary work for 23 years. And my specialty is really stories about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And it's the kind of work I've done for groups like NBC and PBS and really the kind of stories that I love. And when I moved to Denver, I started looking for untold stories of our Wild West. We oftentimes, I think worldwide, have a very narrow concept of American history. And this chapter in particular is oftentimes very, very narrow in its scope. And I think largely because of Hollywood and the Western genre itself. And I felt like there probably were a lot of stories that deserved to be told. And I came across an archive here in Denver at the University of Denver called the Beck Archives of Rocky Mountain Jewish History. And I made an appointment. It sounded promising. I wasn't sure what I would exactly find, but I made an appointment to go down, and I was just blown away by this archive. It's immense in terms of what it has. And the stories are, there was such incredible diversity of people's experiences, how they got out here, what they did when they got here. And no one I knew was familiar with this at all. But I felt that if there was this kind of material in Colorado, there would probably be equally compelling material in places like Texas and New Mexico and California. And as I did a little bit more research, I had discovered that there had been some regional documentaries done about, for instance, the Denver Jewish community or the San Francisco Jewish community at the time. But there had never been a documentary that connected this the dots of this being part of the larger Jewish migration experience in the United States. And I just thought these were incredibly beautiful stories that deserved to be told. I also discovered pretty early on as I was researching it that there's a generation of people today that are the last generation to have direct memories of the Jewish pioneers from the Wild West. So in most cases, this is people who were their grandparents or great-grandparents. And so I did feel also that there was a real urgency to try to get this on camera and get these wonderful stories told.
Right. Well, look, let's talk about some of these pioneers. What were some of the positive contributions that Jews made to the American frontier?
Right. So the film focuses on a period of 1840 to 1920, which is quite a widely sort of accepted as generally what the Wild West period was. So the Wild West in itself, you know, is very much a period of time where you have thousands and thousands of people pouring in from all over the world, driven largely by the economic possibility of mining. And there's sort of two pieces of that. There's the mining itself, and then there's the economies that then came out of all these people showing up in the West. And for Jewish immigrants that were coming in, for many, you know, there's a really wide range of what people ended up doing and how they ended up getting here. You know, for a lot of people coming in, there's sort of two waves. There's one coming in from Prussia in the 1840s, 1850s, and then there's a second, much larger wave of Jewish immigrants coming in from Eastern Europe, starting about 1881 until kind of the early 1920s. And, you know, in both cases, you know, you had systemic anti-Semitic oppression in Europe for hundreds of years. There were severe limitations as to what Jewish men specifically could do in terms of occupations. And that's where peddling comes out of. Peddling wasn't a choice. It's a way to keep people poor. But people showed up with peddling backgrounds primarily. And it wasn't uncommon for someone to come into the West, oftentimes as a young teenager, and peddle from foot, from boomtown to boomtown. And if you got just enough success, you could open up a general store. And it didn't really take that much success to open up retail because rent was cheap and you could usually buy goods on credit. And I think one of the things that I had not really thought about before, but was the importance of general stores in boomtown life in the West and what impact that they had. So these general stores that were oftentimes opened up by Jewish merchants, not always, but oftentimes, really became the center of town social life, of business life. It's where people came to do business. Oftentimes these general stores would become the first post offices. And it's not uncommon in little boom towns to have found some of the time the first mayors would be Jewish, not because people wanted that title, but because they were already doing the job. And so you oftentimes also find the first fire departments, the first schools, libraries can be traced back to these Jewish merchant families, which I think is such an incredibly beautiful contribution and legacy of immigration in this country. So that was sort of an interesting thing that I came across that I hadn't expected. One of the other interesting pieces that I did not know of prior to this is that in Europe, from some of this period and predating it, one of the other occupations that was sometimes permissible by the non-Jewish world was cattle trading. So usually the Jewish community was not allowed to own land in Europe. So they weren't ranchers, but they were cattle traders. And there's a whole industry of trading cattle. And yes, that is the heart of really, you know, the cattle industry. And so for a small group of people, there were Jewish immigrants that came out and had an existing skill set that was of real value at this place in time. So in the film, we talk about a group of Denver cattlemen that were really integral in the forming of the Denver stockyards, which were and remain some of the most important stockyards in the country. We only cover the U.S. in the film, but interestingly, there were a group of Denver cattlemen also in Calgary, Canada, for the same reasons. So people came out and they had a skill set and were willing to work hard and do that. And that was a value. So, but you do, I mean, I think that it certainly was not limited to certainly peddling or general stores or cattle trading by any means. I mean, people opened up, you know, all sorts of different kind of stores, whether it was, you know, bars or hotels or laundries or anything you could imagine somebody might need or want. There's Jewish entertainers in the film. You know, there's really a wide range, I think, of experiences. And I wanted to make sure that the film really reflected that.
Right, right. And I want to know, when Jews came over to America, were they able to keep their religious beliefs? Were they able to preserve the religious beliefs that they had kept for so long?
So there was less anti-Semitism in the West than there were in other parts of the United States at the time, specifically the East Coast. And so when people got out to the West, I think that there was, in some respects, a respite. It wasn't that it was not existent. It did exist for certain. But it was not uncommon, I think, especially with the Eastern Europeans. Many Eastern Europeans that came out were Orthodox and established Orthodox synagogues. Oftentimes, especially in little boom towns, there wasn't necessarily enough of a Jewish population to maintain a full-time rabbi. And we actually tell a story of a female well, she wasn't a rabbi, but a woman named Ray Frank, who didn't actually become a rabbi, but she was part of what was called, it was a rabbi circuit. So in the Wild West, if you couldn't have a full-time rabbi, there was an ability to sort of maybe book people for high holidays and that sort of thing. And Ray Frank actually participated in that, had a manager that got her on the rabbi circuit. But I think one of the things that is also, I found really beautiful about this story was the maintaining of Jewish identity when there wasn't, as one of our interviewees says, necessarily a lot of people to help hold yourselves together. Sometimes in these small towns, you know, it would only be a handful of Jewish families. And yet people did maintain their Jewish identity in the midst of all this incredible diversity of people coming in from all over the world and, there being a very diverse indigenous population existing here already. And they embraced the diversity, but also maintained that Jewish identity. And I think that that is, in many ways, the story of the diaspora throughout the world and throughout history. I think it's one of the most, I find as someone who is not Jewish myself, looking in from the outside, I think it's one of the most beautiful pieces of Jewish history. And I think that that Jewish pride is very much a form of resilience, oftentimes to the anti-Semitism people have faced.
It's so true. And you mentioned a moment ago that there was less anti-Semitism in the West than there was on the East Coast, which I think some of our listeners might find a bit surprising, because I think to a lot of people, New York is considered a kind of a safe place for Jewish people. It's a very Jewish place. Why was there less anti-Semitism on the East Coast, or on the West Coast, sorry?
Sure. So the period that we're looking at, you know, people are coming from Europe where there is systematic, legalized anti-Jewish hate, violence, oppression. As I mentioned, extreme limitations on terms of occupation of what you could do. Owning land wasn't possible. Carrying a firearm wasn't possible. There's, you know, we talk about in the film, there was a period in Prussia that marriage wasn't possible for many, many Jewish families, unless you had a certain income level, which, because people were being kept poor, didn't really exist. And that was a big impetus for people moving to the United States. That sort of legalized oppression didn't necessarily exist in the United States. And so in that sense, there was greater freedom. But there was also the reality of when you got to New York, where a Jewish immigrant could live was primarily limited to the Lower East Side. People were in crowded tenements. The professions that people were sort of limited to were generally working in the garment industry or peddling. There wasn't the same sort of opportunity and mobility that I think people had expected. I think a lot of the mobility that we talk about, you know, we associate with later in terms of that New York experience oftentimes comes in for a second generation or a third generation, which is not uncommon, I think, in the American immigration experience in general. But for that first generation coming in, it wasn't always what everyone had hoped it would be. And I think the West offered a certain amount of opportunity in that sense. There was also, that we talk about in the film, there was concern about rising anti-Semitism and the impact that the over 2 million Eastern European Jewish immigrants that were not just immigrants, but really refugees in many cases from Eastern Europe, fleeing incredible violence and forced poverty, showing up in New York. There was concern from some of the more established, maybe in some cases, second generation Prussian German community, that this was going to contribute even further to the anti-Semitism that was already rising. And so there was a concerted effort to push people west, which I thought was a very interesting thing. It was organized through something called the Industrial Removal Office. And how that would work is that basically Jewish organizations would find career opportunities in the West. They'd have a kind of a list of what these opportunities were. So if, for example, Pueblo, Colorado needed a cobbler and you got off the boat and you were willing to take a train ticket, off you went to Pueblo, Colorado to become a cobbler. And there's about 75,000 Jewish immigrants during this period that end up in the West because of that effort. There's an offshoot of the Industrial Removal Office, which is now kind of referred to as the Galveston movement. And what happened is the idea was that if people came to New York City, it was oftentimes hard to get people to leave New York City, because even though there was anti-Semitism, there was also community. And so ships were actually rerouted, instead of going into Ellis Island, going into Galveston, Texas. And the idea is you got to Galveston, Texas, and you were given a train ticket to go out into sometimes parts of Texas, but also all the way, you know, throughout the West. Plenty of people ended up in Colorado because of the Galveston movement. That was about probably 10,000 people all in all got moved out through the Galveston movement. And sometimes this worked and sometimes this didn't. I mean, sometimes people got to places like Denver where you had a little bit of an established community and there was support. And then other times people felt incredibly isolated. There wasn't the kind of support that they thought there was going to be. There wasn't that kind of community. They didn't feel necessarily understood where they were. And I think it could be a very lonely experience as well. So, you know, it had mixed results, but, you know, all of that was really driven by the anti-Semitism of the non-Jewish world.
Hey, if you want to stay up to date with the fight against anti-Semitism, why not subscribe to Campaign Against Anti-Semitism? Visit antisemitism.org/act or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube. One bit of the documentary that I found particularly interesting was it speaks about how in the late 1800s, one of the most notable American frontiers was being forged in Alaska. And there was a population of Jews who worked and lived there known colloquially as the Frozen Chosen, which is great. That's a great name. Could you tell us more about the Jews of Alaska?
Sure. So as I mentioned, you know, there's really two narratives to the film. There's the Jewish migration narrative and there is the Wild West narrative itself. And to me, the magic of the film is the intersection of those two experiences, and the stories that made it were the ones I felt had the strongest intersection. So in terms of just general Wild West history, the Alaskan gold rush, gold's discovered in Klondike, and the not until 1896, I believe. So this is almost 50 years after the California Gold Rush. So the Alaska Gold Rush is very similar, I think, in many respects to other gold rushes that happened throughout the West, in that you have all these people pouring in from all over the world, all hoping to strike it rich. Very few people ever do. And there are boom towns that then, you know, come up because of that. And there are economies that are built around those boom towns. And so though it's happening, say, 50 years later from California, it's very kind of similar in that model of that you have people that are coming in starting in 1896, seeing this as a great opportunity. I mean, this was, you know, really all eyes in the world were on, you know, I think Nome, Alaska was a big part of this as well. And, you know, people hoped to have better opportunity, you know, and this is coinciding, you know, 1896, you're right in the middle of this mass exodus of Eastern Europeans, right? So you have, starting in 1881, there's this really uptick in pogroms and violence in Eastern Europe. And then that continues. And then there is the Anti-Immigration Act in the United States that happens in, I believe it's 1926, which basically limits people being able to come. Jewish immigrants can't come at that point. And of course, this all is the kind of the precursor to what eventually becomes the Holocaust. But from that period, smack in the middle of that is the Alaskan gold rush. And I think that, you know, people showed up and they opened stores, they opened bars, they opened what might have been needed. Some were miners. I read there was a rabbi from Alaska, a modern day rabbi that's around today, wrote an article a couple of years ago in the Jerusalem Post. His name is Abram Goodstein. And he wrote about growing up in Alaska now and being a rabbi today. And, you know, he talked about in this article, I thought was so interesting, about how as a kid, he always thought that bar mitzvahs happened during the summer. And he didn't realize that that was just this Alaska thing, because in the summer is the easiest time to travel. And so it's the easiest time to invite family and friends. But he didn't realize it was not a seasonal thing until he, you know, was a little bit older, which I thought was very cute. And he also talked about in this article about how Shabbat could be very tricky in Alaska, because there's this wide range of when is sunset, depending on the time of year, right? So you have these really long days during the summer and these very short days during the winter. And but I think in many respects, that's reflective of that diaspora experience of trying to adapt to where you are, but also maintain that Jewish identity. And doing that successfully, even if sometimes it does have its unusual challenges. And so I think that was very much, I'm sure, historically the experience, I'm sure, of Jewish immigrants as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now that's something I love about the documentary. It takes a look at different locations like Alaska and Texas. It looks at movements and trends. It also looks at individuals and individual stories. One story that I thought particularly stood out for me, it was the story of Levi Strauss, a Bavarian Jewish man who would go on to be the person behind the global clothing brand Levi Strauss & Co., famed for their jeans and denim. We learn that Levi actually had to leave his home country due to anti-Semitic edicts affecting Jewish businesses and laws aimed at curbing Jewish population growth. What is Levi's story?
Sure. So we interview Levi's biographer, Lynn Downey, and there is a biography called Levi Strauss, which I highly recommend. It's a fascinating read. Lynn was hired by the Levi Strauss company in the 1980s to try to piece together his history. A lot of it had been lost in fires, and there was a lot of sort of mishistory as to like what his story was. And so that book, the biography of Levi Strauss, is absolutely fascinating. And I think there's sort of two pieces to that. There's the Levi's personal story that's included in that book. And then there is also, it was sort of interesting to me, the kind of general Wild West Jewish experience story that's also included in that. So for example, there's really kind of two pieces of moving goods in the West at that period, which is there's wholesale and there's retail. So the Strauss family, Levi had older stepbrothers, and they had gone to New York before he did, and they had established themselves in the kind of mercantile industry in New York. So when he eventually came, his father passed away. His mother was his father's second wife and much younger, and he, I believe he and his sister came with his mother at that point. He was the younger brother in all of this. And there was an opportunity coming out of the California gold rush to establish wholesale in the San Francisco Bay Area because wholesalers were needed to be able to distribute to retail throughout the West. And there's sort of a difference between wholesale and retail this period because you have wholesale requires a real capital investment. So you really do have to be already established in terms of having the capital to buy goods, having the supply routes to get the goods and all that. Retail, you can kind of jump into retail without as much capital and without as much experience. So Levi went out to San Francisco to do this, and he was really brilliant when it came to establishing supply routes. That was really his skill set. And he very quickly gets these supply routes going, and he gets this really amazing network of retailers throughout the West and in eventually even into like Hawaii. And he's selling all sorts of different dry goods that may be needed. It's not jeans specifically, but he has this great supply route, and he was really respected and well known for his integrity when he did business, as well as giving back to like the not only the Jewish community but the broader San Francisco community. So he's a very respected businessman. And there is a tailor in Reno, Nevada, Jacob Davis, who he comes up with the idea of blue jeans, basically, in a nutshell. And he doesn't have the money to be able to get a patent. And so he reaches out to Levi Strauss. And because Levi Strauss is known for his integrity, I mean, he could have just taken this idea and stolen it. But because he's known for his integrity, Jacob Davis felt comfortable enough to send him a sample, send him this request. And he immediately gets back to him and says, yes, let's do it. And so they file this patent. And that is the birth of blue jeans. I think what's so interesting about blue jeans is I can't think of really a single clothing item that has not changed in over 100 years that we all wear day to day. I mean, that's wild to me, right? Yeah. And so it really did change the face of everything, right? They were workmen's pants. They lasted. That was why this was a necessary thing when you're out with these miners needing pants that last. but obviously it's just become so ubiquitous to all of our fashion, our blue jeans. So I love that story of Levi Strauss, and it's not something that we oftentimes stop and think about. You know, where did this come from? And it's the collaboration of two amazing Jewish immigrants.
Yeah, it's really, really a good chunk of the documentary. I really like it. Now, jumping ahead to 1920, 1921, the documentary tells us that about this time, activity from the white supremacist Ku Klux Klan had been documented in areas such as New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, and Colorado. What do we know about the Klan's how the Klan's presence affected Jews living in these places?
So, you know, I think kind of going back to our really narrow concept of American history, you know, we oftentimes associate the Klan as only being a Southern American experience, and that's simply not true. So there was a Klan's presence that becomes more formalized and prevalent in the 1920s. This is all coinciding with a rise in anti-Semitism worldwide, which, you know, obviously ends up leading up to the Holocaust in Europe. But this was a worldwide phenomenon that was happening. And that, unfortunately, fit nicely with the Klan's kind of ideology. I think that the KKK, you know, in Colorado specifically, there's a huge KKK presence that lasts up into the 70s, which people oftentimes aren't aware. Yeah, I mean, it goes on and on and on. And there's a very overtness in that Klan presence of, you know, showing up to public events. And, you know, I came across, there's a very briefly in the film, you'll see it. There's an advertisement in Amarillo, Texas for a Klan recruitment cowboy barbecue, asking people to come on down to the barbecue and join the Klan in Amarillo, Texas. And I think that, you know, we don't often question that history. We don't have to think about that. And it did have, you know, I think the Klan's, when you talk about Klan history, there's kind of two things that happen with that. One, there's like Klan events, you know, Klan lynchings, things like that. And then there's just the overall impact that this, you know, PR message basically sends out in terms of hate and the impact that has. And I think the silence that surrounds anti-Semitism so much, and this includes this even today, really creates a culture of tolerance for this hate, which is really dangerous. And so I think the Klan, you know, that PR piece of it may be the more successful element of the Klan and what kind of like resonates, I think, today. I mean, it continues on in that sense. So I think that the relatively, you know, compared to the East Coast, less anti-Semitism that existed in the Wild West starts to shift. And the film does not go past 1920 for that reason, because I feel like it also becomes a different experience for people. There becomes a lot more, I think, and there still is opportunity and people are still, you know, they're mobile and they're building businesses and doing things. But, you know, for example, there's a hospital very close to me, Rose Hospital in Colorado, that was established in 1948. And it was established largely because both within the Jewish doctors and also other minority doctors could not get jobs at hospitals post-World War II in Colorado. It was just like impossible. And so Rose established largely to create those opportunities for Jewish doctors. It was actually the first hospital to hire a Black physician, but it was started largely by the Jewish community here in Colorado and still exists as a fantastic hospital today, but came out of because of that reason. There were two Jewish laborers. There were junkmen in 1905 that were working down in downtown Denver that were working on Christmas Day and loading up, you know, scrap metal onto the rail cars. And a mob showed up and killed one of them. The last names were Weisskind and Slotkin. And killed Weisskind, and Slotkin was severely injured. The leader of this mob apparently got like 4 years in prison. That was it. You know, so I think that, you know, this is an ongoing issue that, you know, unfortunately is cyclical. And, you know, the West has seen its fair share of that.
Mm-hmm. It has. And I want to ask you, what is Jewish life in the American West like today?
Sure. So, you know, what happened is you had, you know, Jewish families that came out here and, you know, some did not like it and went back, you know, to the East Coast, or in some cases even went back to Europe. But many stayed. Many people stayed. And so, you know, Temple Emmanuel, which is here, and Rabbi Joe Black is the senior rabbi there and is in the film and worked as an advisor on the film, along with Ben M. Freeman, who we both know and adore. Rabbi Black, you know, leads Temple Emmanuel, and they are about to celebrate, I believe it's their 150th anniversary, and is one of the largest Reform congregations in this part of the country. I think has close to, I want to say, 3,000 families. It's really large. And there continue to be Orthodox synagogues here that are thriving. And, you know, I think that it's this was the origins of those communities, was this time period for the most part.
Amazing. I'm going to ask you a question now that I ask all of our guests, which is, if someone who is not Jewish approaches you and says they want to help in the fight against anti-Semitism, where should they start?
So I myself, as I mentioned, am not Jewish. And when I approached this film, I very quickly realized I needed to become better educated about anti-Semitism, for one. And I was able to connect with Ben M. Freeman, who is, as you know, an incredible Jewish educator, author of Jewish Pride, and also a second book called Reclaiming Our History. Both are fantastic reads. I highly recommend them. As someone who's not Jewish, I felt it was, both of them were very helpful in terms of me really getting a better understanding of anti-Semitism. I think one of the key pieces of Ben's message, which I think is so important, is that, you know, anti-Semitism is the problem of the non-Jewish world. It comes from the Jewish world. It's not something that's created by the Jewish world. It's created by the non-Jewish world. And so as a non-Jewish person, you do have a responsibility. You do have a role in standing up against that. And I think a really important piece of that is listening to and amplifying Jewish voices. So I appreciate being invited on here to talk, but ultimately I feel like this is about listening to Jewish voices. The film, for example, has no narrator. That was intentional. Almost everyone in the film identifies as Jewish. And I felt like that was really, to me, the important piece of why should we do this film? Like, why does this matter today? And I felt like if I could provide a platform to share these Jewish experiences, to share these contributions, to share these perspectives, that in itself hopefully was a means of trying to stand up to anti-Semitism. But I think if you are a non-Jewish person and you're trying to sort of sort this out, I think you need to pick up a couple books, start there, start with Ben's book, Jewish Pride. It's a great place to start. It's not the end of your education, but it's definitely a great, I think, primer of getting started on that. Start following podcasts such as this one. Start listening to Jewish advocates. It was an amazing, Ben is part of an amazing group of young advocates that and activists that are doing an incredible job trying to combat anti-Semitism online. But ultimately, this is the non-Jewish world's responsibility. And ultimately, more non-Jewish people need to recognize that. And, you know, I think really do a better job of helping Jewish voices get out there.
Yeah, I think that's a really thoughtful, good answer. And not just because you plugged the podcast, I just thought it was a good answer. Now, Amanda, please tell the listeners, where can people find the film and where can people find you if you want to be found?
Sure. The best place to find both is jewsofthewildwest.com. And my email is on there if you'd like to reach out. I'd love to hear from people. One of the most satisfying parts of a filmmaker when you work on a project is I love hearing from people who have stories, particularly family connections to the West. I think it's really an exciting part of all that. The film is available on Amazon and iTunes in the United States. I'm still working on international distribution. And it's also going out to PBS stations across the country. Just started doing that this week, which is really exciting. So, and then, you know, if you have any interest and you're not in the United States particularly, if you have any interest in having a screening, you know, for a synagogue, community center, you know, you name it, please reach out, because I'd love to do that. I would love to get it out to more people, particularly around the world.
Awesome. All right. Amanda Kinsey, thank you so much for coming on Podcast Against Anti-Semitism.
Well, it was my pleasure and honor, and thank you for all the incredible, important, hard work you're doing on this issue.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Podcast Against Antisemitism. If you did, please subscribe and leave us a nice rating, or email any feedback to podcast@antisemitism.org. Until next Thursday, stay safe.